So, Jay, any relationship between that guy Hemingway in Gene Nation and, you know, the writer?
Well, there's none officially established, but I suppose it's always possible.
Ooh, wait, so Ernest Hemingway exists in the Marvel Universe?
Sure. He used to hang with Wolverine and Puck.
What?!
I'm Jay Editon.
And I'm Miles Stokes.
And we are here to explain the X-Men.
Because it's about time someone did.
Welcome to episode 447 of Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men, where we walk you through the ins, the outs, and the retcons of comics' greatest superhero soap opera.
And welcome to another event crossover. Another one. Already.
It's not only a crossover, it's an event. It's got a name. Everything's an event these days.
That is something that's been interesting about this era. I mean, we had the Hunt for Xavier recently, we had the Magneto War, and now we have a two-issue crossover called War of the Mutants, which is a crossover consisting of the 50th issues of Generation X and X-Man. That's right, we are covering a Nate Gray story.
I feel like they're trying really hard to make Fetch happen with both the continual events and with the title of this one, because this is not a war. This is like Skirmish of the Mutants. Minor altercation of the mutants.
Slight philosophical disagreement of the mutants. Different favorite colors of the mutants.
I mean, they do actually hit each other.
Well, you know, it's the Marvel Universe. It's full of punching.
Well, and it's Nate Gray, who is incapable of starting a conversation without also starting a fight.
So true. But I feel like we should let folks know what's been up with Generation X, and also, since we don't actually cover the X-Man comic, just what the deal is with Nate Gray.
So he's hooking up with the ghost of his alternate universe mom.
I figured we would start with Generation X.
Ah, the easy stuff.
Yeah, well, I guess Nate's easy in his own way, but we digress.
So Generation X are the current teenage X team, or X students. They have been students so far at the Massachusetts-based Xavier School for Gifted Youngsters, formerly Emma Frost's Massachusetts Academy.
But the times, they are a-changin', because while former X-Man Banshee and former White Queen of the Hellfire Club Emma Frost are still running the place, thanks to financial difficulties, they are now joined by a third co-headmaster.
Adrian Frost, Emma's rich and even shittier sister.
What hasn't changed is the team's membership. We still have Jubilee, Husk, Sink, Chamber, M, Skin, and newcomer Gaia, who's a pink-haired reality manipulator who was trapped in another dimension for thousands of years before joining the school last semester.
Although they reduced it again to 600 in one of the issues we're covering today.
Make up your mind, Marvel Comics. There may be some continuity issues in this shared superhero universe. Maybe.
Just a few.
Well, so that's Generation X. Things are kind of standard-ish for them, with the exception of the school's recent takeover and what's about to happen.
Now, you can't talk about Generation X, use the phrase Generation X, without discussing alienation.
Yes, and one of the most alienated teens of all is an alien to this reality, because Nate Gray is not from the main Marvel Universe, Earth 616. He has escaped the literally post-apocalyptic alternate reality,
Earth 295,
the Age of Apocalypse. So Nate Gray, as you might gather from his first name, and to a lesser extent his last, is Earth 295's teenage non-cyborg version of familiar Earth 616 character, Cable. And since coming to Earth 616, Nate has been superheroing around, getting in misunderstanding-based fights with other heroes, making out with hot ladies, including, as you said,
the ghost of Madeline Pryor.
Yeah, that's, of course, the seemingly resurrected mom of Nate's alternate reality self. So that's a thing. It's not relevant, but how could you not mention it?
Wasn't he also a rock star briefly?
He was a rock star briefly, also a psychic in Central Park, and a messiah later, a shaman. He's worn a lot of hats, none of which involved actual hats, and only some of which involved actual shirts.
And many of those shirts were mesh.
Mm-hmm.
Because an important thing about Nate Gray is that he dresses for any eventuality, assuming that eventuality takes place at a club.
Isn't the whole world a club?
I mean, I guess it is when you are X-Man, Nate Gray.
Indeed. But we do not start with X-Men Nate Gray. We start with Generation X number 50, War of the Mutants Part 1, Divided We Fall.
Written by Jay Farber, penciled by Terry Dodson, inked by Rachel Dodson, colored by John Callis, lettered by Richard Starkings and Comicraft, and Saito Tamafonte. So things are tense at the Massachusetts Academy, formerly the New Xavier Institute, formerly the Massachusetts Academy.
Yeah, the name has been changed ever since Adrian Frost took over.
And this is because, as Adrian aptly points out, ever since Onslaught, the name Xavier doesn't actually inspire that much confidence, which is going to be rough for a lot of Catholic schools.
Adrian also points out that she kind of wants it to be the way it was in the old days, you know, the family's old place. She's very big on prestige and feeling special, like a lot of shitty executives.
And because the school is broken, because she wants to return to those halcyon days, they are admitting human students again. Ew.
Yeah, because of course the old Massachusetts Academy, back when Emma Frost tutored the Hellions, had a whole bunch of human students going there and paying lots and lots of money to do so. And I love the two-page spread we get of all of these kids coming to the school for the first time as the semester starts. Like, we see all these different parents, all these different kids with all kinds of different dynamics. Some are hugging, some parents are comforting their scared children, some are arguing, some kids are just sort of blowing off their parents as they leave. Like, you get the impression each has a little story. In a way, it almost reminds me of a Where's Waldo two-page spread, where like you can look at different characters interacting in different ways and just sort of imagine what their deal is and what they've been up to and why they're doing what they're doing.
I don't know, man. Waldo's kind of a drifter. I don't think he's rich enough to be at the Massachusetts Academy.
Probably not, but I also don't think that would stop him. Shit, is Waldo on that two-page spread? I mean, I didn't see him, but he's kind of hard to find sometimes. That's the point.
Maybe he can turn invisible. Maybe he's a mutant.
Whoa. Okay, wait. Is Waldo Forget-Me-Not?
No, because people are always looking for him.
Good point. Good point. Well, anyway, I was reading about this because I seem to recall that the school had been open to humans at other times. And one thing that I came to was that that was actually one of Grant Morrison's plans. Had they continued for longer on New X-Men, which I think was initially their intention, they would have had humans join the Xavier School, and the book would become about, among other things, whether extremely gifted humans and mutants were really all that different.
I mean, that's not the vector based on which the country has been legislating against my existence, but, you know.
Grumble, grumble, real world, grumble.
Real world sucks.
It's not great in a lot of ways, it's true.
Earth 616 also sucks for everyone, though, so, you know.
But at least it sucks with people wearing colorful outfits.
That's true. Man, I want the future we were promised in Hackers.
I want the future we were promised at the beginning of Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
I don't really want to wear that much synthetic stuff.
I mean, I don't know. It's probably more comfortable. They have future tech.
I guess. Anyway, much like me and the fashion of Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, the Generation X kids are not euphoric about the new situation at the Massachusetts Academy, but Skin's got a plan to keep their minds off it.
Okay, let's pause a moment and talk about Skin, because this arc introduces something new with his powers. Normally, Skin has a bunch of extra, well, skin, and he can stretch it all around and stuff like that. But at this point, he seems to have learned to shapeshift, including in ways that make me very curious about how his skeleton is involved in things. Like, I guess this book always played fast and loose with the physics of that, but he's taking it much further. Like, his neck is stretching 3 feet so he can see above his friends at one point.
His skeleton is just very dense skin.
Oh, it's just all skin? He's just made of pure skin? Pure elemental skin? SK on the periodic table?
Is there an SK on the periodic table? I don't think there actually is.
Well, there is now. We can just draw it in with a Sharpie every time we see one.
Just write skin in really uneven, creepy letters, or maybe carve it into the paper?
Yeah. That would make all the scientists happy and very comfortable.
Yes, I don't think they would feel threatened by that at all.
No. Listeners, carve skin into every periodic table you see, and then make constant eye contact and smile if anyone sees you doing it. No, don't do any of those things. Don't listen to our podcast. What are you doing? We're terrible at advice.
Go do something else. Go touch grass. But not like that.
No. But with your skin. Skin.
So Adrian's plan for this is that the mutants who can't pass as human are all going to pretend to have medical disorders. So Skin is going to have a pigmentation disorder. Chamber's going to be a burn victim. I think they're actually the only two who aren't human passing right now.
I think so, yeah. Skin's pretty amused. He says he's just going to learn to play, like, what's very clearly Quasimodo from the Disney movie.
Yeah, he wants to pretend to have elephantitis and live in a bell tower, he says.
Yeah. Angelo. That's Angelo.
He's a fun kid. He's generally much more easygoing about the whole situation than his teammates. And by the whole situation, I mean not only what's going on at the school, but sort of the general climate of hate and fear of mutants. At one point, he's rescuing a civilian who doesn't want to be touched by a mutant and reassures him, saying,
I'm not a mutant. I was bitten by a radioactive elephant, which turned my skin gray and gave me the power to stretch.
Oh, that's okay then.
Alas, the kids are all being watched from afar by Dark Beast. Let's get a recap of Dark Beast's deal.
Much like Nate Gray, Dark Beast is a shirtless refugee from Earth 295.
Specifically, he's the Age of Apocalypse's version of, as you might guess, Beast.
Hank McCoy. However, on Earth 295, that point, in contrast of Earth 616, Hank McCoy was decidedly and definitively evil.
An evil mad scientist. And at this point in the 90s in Earth 616, he's leading a new crew. He was on the Brotherhood of Mutants with Havoc. That didn't work out. Now he's leading Gene Nation, a group we haven't seen in a little while.
Now, this was Marrow's anti-human terrorist group, and it's composed of Morlocks from the Hill. Do you remember what the Hill was?
Oh yeah, that was that dimension that Colossus's brother teleported all the Morlocks to, and we thought the Morlocks died, but really they just went to a dimension where time flowed differently and everything was based on fighting and rain.
I think some of them did die.
Well, yes, and then some more died in the Hill. But yeah, the Gene Nation were a bunch of Morlocks who came back, some of whom having aged up to adulthood from childhood, like Marrow, and they were going to kill 100 humans for every mutant who'd been killed way back in the Mutant Massacre, and did in fact kill quite a few.
They gave up on this after Storm ripped out Marrow's heart, but before it turned out that Marrow had a spare.
It was a whole thing. So Marrow, of course, is on the X-Men now. She's not on Gene Nation. However, the remaining members of Gene Nation are with Dark Beast. And let's just do a quick rundown because they'll be all over this arc. We've seen a few of them before.
All right. So one of them is the vaguely named Vessel. He is a large green man with vines and worms growing throughout his body. He absorbs souls of the dead to get tougher and regenerate.
I really love powers like that, especially in the 90s where so many characters just have generic energy powers. He's like, no, 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 I'm a big plant-based zombie guy who holds on to souls, which then presumably can't go to, I don't know, heaven or whatever.
What would happen if he and Omega Red were like in the same room?
Oh, because Omega Red's got the mutant death factor? Well, I think it could work out quite well. The death factor would kill a bunch of people, and then Vessel would absorb all their souls. And then Omega Red and...
Okay, what about Threnody?
Threnody? Oh, so she feasts on the pain of people as they die. So people would die. They'd have to be killed somehow, maybe by Omega Red. Threnody would feast on their pain, and then the souls, which would be in no pain, would be absorbed by Vessel, and maybe they wouldn't mind because they were in a good mood.
But could the death factor itself feed Vessel?
I don't think so, because I think Vessel feeds on life, on stealing life.
Ah, I see. Not on death, but on the life that is lost in the process of death.
Important distinction.
It is an important distinction. So the next one is one who delights me, because his name is Hemingway for absolutely no reason I can discern. Like, the other characters have code names that sort of make sense based on their powers, and this dude's just like, no, my powers are hanging out being, like, weirdly homoerotically macho on Key West with weird cats.
And while he's homoerotic on Key West with weird cats, he's a big gray guy who just straight up looks like Doomsday from DC.
Then there's Membrane, spelled M-E-M-B-R-A-I-N. He explains his name several times. He's green and blobby, and he produces sort of mucusy slime, which is psychic.
Yeah, he can use the slime for remote viewing. It's a whole thing. Also, for any Pokemon fans, he looks kind of like an Alolan Grimer.
Is that the singer who was married to Elon Musk?
No, but now I'm imagining if it was.
Finally, we've got Fever Pitch. Fever Pitch is a flaming skeleton. That's it. That's his thing.
I mean, he's a flaming skeleton who can fly and, like, shoot fire at people.
I mean, are you going to tell a flaming skeleton what he can and can't do?
No. No, he'd set me on fire.
Exactly. All right, there are also characters named Obsidian, Iron Maiden, and Winter, but spelled with a Y to make it extra cool.
Oh, like Strife. Anyway, the point is, Dark Beast and Gene Nation, using membrane psychic slime, are watching the kids. They want to kidnap the kids so that Dark Beast can do evil science on them.
In the process of this, by the way, Dark Beast claims that he's living in the sewers for fear that someone will mistake him for Hank McCoy of Earth 616, which is kind of funny considering that he deliberately passed as Hank of Earth 616 for a fairly long time.
Well, right, and it went terribly, so now he wants to make sure it doesn't happen again.
No, that's fair. I mean, he could just wear a hat.
You know, in the Marvel Universe, that is often enough. Maybe a trench coat, and then your disguise is perfect.
An eye patch?
Two eye patches.
And this Hank McCoy, Dark Beast, is looking for New Mutant specimens for his diabolical experiments, and he has settled on the Generation X kids as his new subjects. But he is not the only one on the prowl for fresh mutant blood, because Emma Frost, always looking to beef up her team, sees Nate Gray on TV and decides that he'd be a perfect addition to the school.
So one of the things that I wanted to talk about here is a phrase I learned from my therapist, and I'm sure is all over the place. In times of stress, we regress. Emma is very stressed right now because her shitty sister now half runs the school, and the last time the school had a bunch of human students, all of her mutant students got killed.
Is your therapist the demon Etrigan?
Never asked. Maybe. But it makes sense that Emma would then go on a recruiting frenzy, because of course she did that all the time when she was, you know, a bad guy. She tried to recruit Shadowcat and Dazzler in the Phoenix Saga back in the day.
She recruited the hell out of Firestar.
Oh boy, did she recruit Firestar. She recruited her so hard that her pony burst into flames. Well, okay, technically died in a barn fire, but still.
Now, the news describes Nate Gray in a way that really delights me, which is as a telepathic mutant with a record of highly publicized battles, which is accurate given that he pretty much says hello by starting fights.
Hello, sir. How may I help you?
You're not my real dad! So Emma decides that the best way to do this is to establish a mind link with Nate, and in doing so, she accomplishes two things. First, she interrupts a weird conversation with Nate's quasi-incestuous girlfriend slash alternate universe mother, the ghost of Madeline Pryor, as we mentioned. Second, she both stirs up his memories of Dark Beast and makes it clear that Emma also knows Dark Beast. Because remember, Emma's got that history from Generation X minus one.
Yeah, Emma met up with Dark Beast when he was all disoriented from switching universes, and she agreed to help him get his memories and knowledge back in exchange for protection.
And Nate goes, oh shit, a clue to the location of that one dude who I promised to kill, or one of the dudes I promised to kill. Anyway, Dark Beast is bad news. So he whips off to Massachusetts. Which takes us back to the teens. The teens are distracting themselves from their human woes by hanging out in Boston. And at this point, 3/4 of the female members of the team have crushes on Sync.
Jeez, Everett, who are you? Rand Al Thor?
Who's that?
Well, he's the main character of The Wheel of Time. The only two types of women in The Wheel of Time are women in love with Rand Al Thor or women not yet in love with Rand Al Thor. The show's much better about it.
I haven't seen the show yet, but yeah, no, pretty much. He's all the girls, except for Paige, who is busy being grumpy about Chamber, are head over heels for him. And Monet claims him for the day. At which point, Jubilee, Gaia, and Husk go off together, leaving Skin and Chamber. And so we're going to follow each of these groups of students. Let's start with Skin and Chamber.
Yeah, they're just going for a walk, they're talking, they head over to a boat, but no sooner can they cross any body of water, which proves that they are not vampires, although Chamber almost was one time, than a skeleton on fire attacks.
Wait a minute, Dracula totally crossed the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah, but he was in like a box of dirt, which makes it fine.
You don't know what's on that boat.
A box of dirt.
Anyway, a skeleton on fire attacks. It is not Ghost Rider. It is Fever Pitch. And he's got flaming orange word balloons, which is how you know that he's going to probably stick around for more than one issue.
I love that gimmick. I will never get sick of characters having their own special word balloons. I'm sure that's because I first noticed it reading Sandman, which I love. But, like, I just do it all the time. Every character should have their own word balloons, make it impossible to follow what's going on and really hard to read and cool to look at.
So Fever Pitch's powers are fairly similar to Chambers, but fire-based, and basically burned away his whole body. And he manages to collar and subdue Chamber very easily, and Skin, meanwhile, is trying to get a civilian overboard back to safety, and he ultimately says that he'll go voluntarily with Fever Pitch if he can rescue the dude first, and Fever Pitch, being a reasonable skeleton on fire, agrees.
I actually really like that Fever Pitch is like, well, I'm clearly an evil villain, I mean, look at me, but no, that's a fair deal, sure, no prob.
It reminds me a little bit of Random here in that he's here to do a fairly specific job for a fairly specific purpose, and this doesn't really get in the way of it, so whatever.
Yeah, well done, Skeleton on Fire, in this specific regard, if few others.
Now, while they are fighting a Skeleton on Fire, Monet takes Sync to a tattoo parlor, and she explains her reasoning.
I spent more time than I care to remember trapped in a razor-sharp body, unable to touch or be touched. Getting a tattoo would almost be like a celebration of being able to be touched again.
Also, she super wants to touch Everett, but they are interrupted by Membrane, who attacks them after politely explaining both his powers and his name.
It doesn't work out because Monet's telepathy and syncing Monet's telepathy just makes them more vulnerable to Membrane's psychic slime. So he knocks them out and drags them both off. But I have a question. What kind of tattoo do you think Monet would get?
Very tasteful heart with your mom in it.
Yeah, fair enough. Jubilee, Gaia, and Husk are talking about their assorted boy troubles before they get on a trolley, which is then attacked by Hemingway, the big gray dude. Wait a minute. Skin and Chamber try to get on a boat and are attacked. These folks try to get on a trolley and are attacked. What do boats, trolleys, and tattoo parlors have in common? Tattoo parlors aren't vehicles, unless they're a vehicle to looking cooler.
All of them contain the letter T.
Okay, so listeners, if you want to avoid Gene Nation, don't go anywhere with the letter T in its name. You could go to a cloud. Or a bar. But not a restaurant.
This is also where we learn that Generation X continues the New Mutants tradition of wearing their uniforms under clothes for warmth, which means that their clothes can get shredded with no inappropriate nudity.
Well, also it means you know it's fight time because they're in their superhero outfits.
That is also true, and Hemingway and Vessel fairly neatly subdue and nab Jubilee and Husk, but they leave an unconscious Gaia for dead. Which is their mistake, because Gaia comes to, grabs Sean's Jeep, which apparently they take into town, and runs Emma Frost off the road to alert her to what's going on.
And of course, that is when everybody's favorite misunderstanding-based brawler Nate Gray flies in a trail of energy and demands to know everything Emma knows about the Dark Beast. That's right, it's the classic Nate Gray plot, one of the basic narrative structures, man versus misunderstanding.
Meanwhile, back at the Massachusetts Academy, Banshee is on the phone with someone he wants as a gym teacher, never named, when he spots a helicopter kidnapping a student on one of the security monitors and heads off.
It's pretty great. He's about to take off Superman style when he looks over and notices that there's a random family of humans next door. So he just turns it into a really awkward run. It's so good.
He follows the helicopter to Vermont, where a large man with a bad goatee knocks him straight out of this crossover and into the following issue, which we will be covering at a later date. Now, however, we come to X-Man number 50. Oh, wow, this is a milestone issue, too. War of the Mutants, Part 2, New Blood.
Written by Terry Cavanaugh, penciled by Luke Ross, inked by Bud LaRosa, colored by Mike Thomas, and lettered by Richard Starkings and Comicraft. And yes, indeed, this issue opens, as so many X-Men stories do, with a furious Nate Gray wielding immense psychic energies as he floats above someone who's just trying to explain themselves.
And in this case, Emma explains that no, the only reason Nate saw Dark Beast in her mind is that he was an old acquaintance and their shared knowledge of him helped her connect to his mind.
Nate clones himself into a bunch of different teenagers in the sky, threateningly, as he says,
"When you invaded my mind, you mean, witch. Ripped right through my brain, tearing through painful memories, precious memories, no less ruthlessly than the Dark Beast himself would."
"And every bit as easily as I see through your psionic illusions, Gray. A telekinetic puppet show, nothing more, made up of dancing dust and dirt. Showy, but ultimately ineffective against a superior psi."
Yeah, that's X-Man. Everyone is both dumb and impressively dramatic, like if Michael Bay did a telenovela.
Wow. Wow, that's a really upsetting idea.
But it's accurate, right?
I don't know.
So we already covered Emma's past with Dark Beast, how they had an agreement when she was much younger, and he was much newer to Earth-616. As for Nate, I mean, he knew about the Dark Beast in the Age of Apocalypse, certainly, but more recently, back in X-Man number 28 or so, Dark Beast convinced Nate to join the Brotherhood, and it ended up with them trying to kill Nate, as happens. So Nate's, like, extra pissed at Dark Beast.
And he narrates about, you know, what he'd been up to when he noticed Emma's psi probe, but we honestly don't really need to worry about that for now. There's a lot of stuff going on that is absolutely irrelevant to this story.
The most important part is that he's boinking the ghost of his alternate universe stepmom. Anyway, before the fight restarts, Gaia yells at them to just please chill because, you know, Jubilee and Husk were just taken off by monsters and she doesn't know where the rest of the team is either. And that's all Nate needs to hear. Oh, some teenagers have been kidnapped? He will rescue any teenager.
Well, any kid, specifically.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he's actually supposed to be about 17 or so at this point. He looks much older.
He's protagonist years old.
He is protagonist years old. So they head off to adventure. And Emma at this point, in fact, in the middle of the fight from one page to another, switches into her Generation X uniform, which is like the standard red jumpsuit with yellow elbow pads and boots and stuff. But it's white for her. It looks cool every time. I love that that's her battle uniform.
The fact that she just seamlessly does this from her power suit does kind of reinforce the idea that she's always in sweats and just uses telepathy to make everyone see what she wants them to see.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, her hair is actually terrible. She has, like, cowlicks and bedhead all the time, but everyone sees her as perfect.
Yeah, I love that. I love this idea.
Well, it's time to head into the sewers, which, as we know, are the most efficient way of getting anywhere in New York City. I mean, actually, in the Marvel Universe, they kind of are.
With current subway delays, they might actually be in the regular universe, too.
And as they go through the sewers, Gaia and Nate bond over not being used to the world they're in. Nate, because he comes from an alternate dimension, and Gaia, because she was trapped in the Citadel of the Universal Amalgamator for, okay, here she says 600 years, which, don't get me wrong, is a ridiculously long time, but at one point it was mentioned she was there for 13,000 years, which is a comically long time, so I say we go with that.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, she was, the 600 is contained in that.
It's true. It's true. And again, both are almost unfathomable in terms of being chained to a rock, but, you know, one's worse.
She had some books.
Did she?
No.
Just some chains. That's so boring.
A lot of weed.
I hope. Anyway, they follow the trail to where Dark Beast is. You know, Emma's got her psychic-y stuff to figure it out. And they find a 40-foot-high reinforced metal door. It is not subtle, but it does appear to be impregnable. And as they approach, and as Emma realizes that Gen X is probably behind that door, she flashes right back to Uncanny X-Men number 281, when her former students, the Hellions, were killed right in front of her. The most traumatic thing that's ever happened to her. And now she's worried it might happen again.
Now, the door is impregnable to telekinesis, but fortunately, Gaia's powers are really ambiguous, so she can take it out.
Yeah, she telemorphs the door frame around the door so that the door falls. I don't know what telemorph means, but it does sound cool.
So this is actually Emma's call, and she has Gaia basically bring down the door on them, and she dives out of the way, just assuming that you know, Nate and Gaia will be fine.
You had Gaia covered all along, obviously, and it worked, didn't it? I actually really like Emma as getting more and more defensive the more scared she is, more and more sort of cold and closed off and almost petty. Like, I don't know if that's intended by Kavanaugh in this issue, but it works.
So behind the door is indeed Generation X, and they are all in various contraptions being experimented upon. So we've got Skin, you know, being stretched out, Jubilee surrounded by too many fireworks, there are probes on Monet's head, and, you know, some kind of techno spear tearing Husk's skin apart, and Sync's wearing a big metal diaper.
Yeah, he's got those turbine manacles on his feet, and there's a big metal diaper. Okay, Dark Beast, I know that nobody knows what to do with Sync in the 90s, but I'm pretty sure that's not the right answer.
Anyway, New Gene Nation is also here, not wearing metal diapers.
That we see, anyway. So, yeah, Vessel and Hemingway are here, and with Luke Ross's art, they are way the fuck bigger. Like, Hemingway is like a spiky gray Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. It is fucking ridiculous, and I kind of love it. There's also Fever Pitch, the flaming skeleton we met before, and we have a gun-armed cyborg guy named Winter with a Y, Obsidian the Dark, who's like the silhouette of a bog witch. She does almost nothing, but she's great. Iron Maiden, a spiky lady, and Integer, described as...
the mathematical concept who would be a man. I love that. Integer is such a Grant Morrison character.
Integer totally is. He'd be right at home in Doom Patrol. I want to know more about Integer. The Marvel database describes Integer as dreaming of being human and says it's speculated that if he ever solved himself, he would become so. That's actually not in this issue, and this is Integer's only appearance, so I don't know where the database got that, but I love it. So here we go. Integer, our favorite character of this story, who does almost nothing and never shows up again.
Least valuable, but most excellent player.
Yes. So Nate fights everybody, as is his way, while Emma frees Generation X. And once Generation X is free, they join the fight as well. It's actually pretty cool. Sync sinks half his body to the same metal that Husk has ripped her skin off to turn into. Gaia creates like her own reality manipulating version of Iceman's ice sled, but it's made of floor. Skin tangles all of his fingers into these big bludgeoning fists. Jubilee, meanwhile, wonders why she was the last one that Emma freed, even though she used to be an X-Man, which, I gotta say, gets funnier every time Jubilee petulantly mentions it as justification for whatever. Nate is actually kind of impressed.
This is the next generation of mutants you and Frost are so proud of, Gaia? A pack of wild teens with weird powers? Completely out of control? I love him!
Well said, my friend. Well said. So everybody fights everybody. M, of course, goes up against Iron Maiden, the red, sharp lady who reminds M of when she was trapped in her own razor-sharp red form.
As well as...
of the two young innocents now forced to inhabit such a wretched, painful form. Mutant twins forever lost, so that I might live. Oh, I have paid so much to therapists over the years, including Etrigan the Demon, apparently, to get that level of in touch with myself, and Emma's just doing it in the midst of punching a supervillain. That is efficient multitasking, and I am impressed. I love that about superhero comics. Like, it's so ubiquitous, it's almost not worth commenting on, but just the fact that during a fight, which in theory would just take a matter of seconds, minutes at the longest, you have time for not just a bunch of dialogue, but like soul-searching, self-discovery, interaction, misunderstandings, and resolving those misunderstandings, all while you're just like shooting different colored lasers at each other. That's great!
Sync, meanwhile, does his best to sync with Integer and ends up just reciting numbers.
I love it. That's all Integer does. That's all Integer does. Integer doesn't actively do anything.
Integer is so weird.
So weird. Come back, Integer. Be in a comic of some sort. They're relaunching all the X-books. Maybe you can lead your own team.
So, Winter turns out to have been Dark Beast in disguise, or at least a robot operated by Dark Beast, and Emma goes off to find the real one and murder him. But Generation X stops her because the kids just found a hatched brood egg in the base.
Yeah, this kind of comes out of nowhere. Like, apparently Dark Beast got an egg of one of the brood, like the xenomorphs from Alien, essentially, and has let it loose. So, okay, all of a sudden there's an alien in the base. Oh, and also all of a sudden, apparently Winter was a load-bearing cyborg because the entire place is collapsing. I say we keep going. Also, there's a volcano under it. Also, a meteor's about to crash into the place.
Also, Dark Beast turns out to be a hard light hologram.
That actually does happen. It's less disastrous, but it is very disappointing because Nate and Emma both really wanted to kill Dark Beast.
Yeah, and Nate is annoyed, too, that Emma left him and the kids to fight Gene Nation while she went off on her own to finish off Dark Beast. Will the kids even forgive her?
No, probably not. But they'll live with it. They'll live because of it. I know exactly what each and every one of these boys and girls can and cannot do. So I did what I had to do.
This is actually, like, a really interesting Emma Frost. I mean, she's been great in Generation X overall, but I like this regression in her. I like that the trauma being brought up, not by having a bunch of her students die, but just by things that reminded her of the time her last students died. Humans being at the school, all the kids getting, you know, captured, etc. Like, this is bringing out that cold pragmatism that's also based entirely on being incredibly protective of these kids she cares so much about, to the point where she doesn't even care what they think of her.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone gives Grant Morrison credit for revitalizing Emma Frost and making her a fascinating character. And certainly Morrison did a phenomenal job with Emma Frost. I would never deny that. But the seeds of that are all in Generation X. And I'm starting to think the seeds of a lot of it are in this part right here. Like, this is the Emma who will again be re-traumatized when Genosha is destroyed and all those mutants die around her. Like, these are the beginnings of that, almost like a premonition of all the horrible things to come.
I can see that.
Ah, man, Emma's just, she's just so great. She's such a great character. Anyway, Nate Gray force bubbles everybody, and they all fly out of the explosion. Like, again, it's a Michael Bay movie. I really want Michael Bay to do a Nate Gray movie. Can Michael Bay direct an X-Men movie, please? Marvel? Disney?
No.
I'm not saying it would be good, but I am saying it would be great. I mean, you wouldn't be able to tell what the hell was happening in any of the action scenes, but honestly, I can't tell what the hell's happening in X-Men half the time anyway.
Fair.
Once they all get back, Emma, of course, tries again to recruit Nate Gray onto Generation X, and he says, nah.
And then Madeline Pryor shows up and teleports him away.
The end. You know, it's actually kind of surprising that Nate and Generation X haven't done more together. I mean, they are the prominent teen mutants in X-books right now, right? Because, like, X-Force is older. They're not really peers exactly, but Nate totally would be.
But Nate is a solo protagonist, and Generation X is fundamentally an ensemble book.
Very true. And it's kind of hard to imagine Nate being on a team. I mean, he is sometimes. Like, he was on the New Mutants for a while many years later, and I guess that's fine, but that was sort of an older, more mature Nate, and this one just can't fucking get along with anyone. Like, he has a supporting cast, don't get me wrong, but he doesn't really even stay with that many of them for very long. Like, the person with whom he probably has the longest relationship is the ghost of Madeline Pryor, who eventually turns out to be an evil Jean Grey from an alternate dimension anyway. It's a real long story. Yeah, we'll get to that at some point, I'm sure. So, yeah, I like that while Nate enjoys hanging out with the kids, like, he thinks they're fun, there's really not much of a connection. Like, there shouldn't be. There doesn't have to be.
Yeah, Nate Gray does not seem like a teen who would be good at connecting with his peer group.
No, just ghosts of his. Well, we don't need to harp on that more. He does actually have a really interesting relationship with Cyclops. Like, later in his comic, he ends up adopting Cyclops' old X-Factor costume, like the blue and white one with the big X.
Yeah. And he lives with Scott's grandparents for a while, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. So, like, again, he has a supporting cast. He has these great connections, but he is a fundamentally solo character. He's not like Wolverine, where he can work on a team, or Cable, where he can lead a team. Like, he's doing his own thing. He does not play well with others, except when he has misunderstanding-based fights with them.
I would argue that does not count as playing well.
That's how they play.
So, as Nate Gray reminds us all, you've got questions.
Fish That Yells asks on Tumblr, or I guess yells on Tumblr. Well, it's a longer question, but we'll shorten it to the basics, which is, in-universe, who assigns and keeps track of the multiversal designations? You know, like Earth 616 and Earth 295 and all of those.
While this hasn't been officially established, we are fairly sure, like, sure enough to bet on it, that it is someone in the Dimensional Development Court of the Starlight Citadel of Otherworld.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's at the center of the multiverse. It runs the Captain Britain Corps, who protect the multiverse. It decides when to, like, purge universes when they go bad. So somebody in there, probably like a put-upon and entertainingly nebbish clerk drawn by Alan Davis. I can almost picture this character in my head.
Now, technically, though, the main Marvel universe no longer has numerical designations following Secret Wars.
But, like, all the characters, even, and the creators and the fans still call it Earth-616, so, yeah, it's Earth-616. You can't tell us what to do, Secret Wars. Fish That Yells in the full question also asked, like, if there's somebody in charge of preventing silly numbers like Earth-69 and Earth-420 from getting used, and no, I don't think there is. It is an infinite multiverse, so of course there are multiverses based on sex positions and weed. I mean, there's Earth on Fire. That's like one of the dimensions. So of course those exist. And given that the Earth designations are very meta anyway, like they're often based on the month and year when a universe first came out, then sure, there's totally an Earth 69.
Also, 420 is based on not only an Earth, but an American police code. And I would argue that it probably doesn't have the same significance to Otherworld or to the Captain Britain Corps, which is, as its name implies, British.
I thought I recall reading it had a different origin, 420. I don't know.
I may be mistaken. I often am.
Well, regardless, Earth 420 is canon. There. It's official. We said so. That nebbish clerk drawn by Alan Moore is behind me and is nodding in agreement. You just can't see because it's a podcast and we're an audio-only medium.
Sir, I can see you on video, and you are full of lies.
Don't tell them that, Jay! You gotta have my back!
I thought you had a nebbish clerk for that.
Well, I thought I did too!
Carl H. asked on our website, I always pictured the X-Mansion being way out from the urban center, so the Morlock tunnels extend to the basement of the X-Mansion established during the Mutant Massacre always seemed questionable. Looking at maps, it appears that Salem Center is nearly an hour drive from the Bronx. I think X-Men Unlimited number 22 is the first time anyone has tried to explain how this works, although it seems odd for Mero to be explaining it, considering how often the X-Men would have had to use that route. But is it really at all plausible? Does trying to explain it just point out how silly it is? Is there any way to make the tunnels extend 40-plus miles from New York City, or should it just be MST3K'd into I should really just relax?
So, actually, it kind of sort of works. Officially, in the Marvel Universe, the tunnels, the Morlock tunnels, go under New York and New Jersey and Connecticut. Most people don't know about this, but they were built in the 50s by the government as like emergency Cold War shelters and then abandoned. And it was after that that the Morlocks moved in. So in fact, the tunnels are fucking everywhere. They're just under everything. Like I am kind of surprised cities have structural integrity given how much of them is hollow underneath, apparently.
The New York metro area is just a warren.
It's just totally a warren. It's full of rabbits. Morlock rabbits. Everyone's got rabbit ears. Like Marge Simpson almost did under her blue hair back when she was a Life in Hell character. But the alley itself is probably a lot of what people are thinking of. That's like the giant, giant long tunnel that Callisto kidnapped Angel and brought him to, for instance. It's like the Morlock central headquarters. That runs under the length of Manhattan. So I think initially in the comics, I was trying to look at some old ones, and it was never implied that the X-Men went straight from the mansion to the alley. They could get down into the tunnels and then go from there to the alley itself. Later, of course, it got really inconsistent in terms of how different writers portrayed it. But that's the idea. The alley's under Manhattan, and the tunnels go frickin' everywhere, and they will take you to the alley, or from the alley, or around the alley, or under the alley. There are so many prepositions. And above, under, in, around, or with that.
Jay and Miles explain the X-Men's recorded in Forest Hills, New York, and Portland, Oregon, and produced by Matt Hunter, who also arranged our theme music. You can find more of Matt's work at moon-talk.bandcamp.com.
New episodes come out most Sundays on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at explainthexmen.com.
Check out explainthexmen.com for visual companions to every episode.
Our show is 100% listener-supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, and ad-free, check out the Patreon link at the top of explainthexmen.com.
And please take a moment to rate and review us on your favorite podcasting platform. It really helps.
Next week, X-Force fights the new Hellions.
You know, because the old ones are dead. If I search for element SK, it takes me to element skateboards.
Skateboardium.